danger is stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day when you give in. Give in. Give in. Give in.
Hello and welcome to episode 243 of the Thinking Poker Podcast from Melrose, Massachusetts. I'm Nate Mavis, and with me from Owings Mills, Maryland. Is that right?
Owings Mills, Maryland is correct.
Yeah, it's Andrew Brokus. How are you, Andrew?
I'm doing okay. I actually, I think on the previous episode, I made a reference to getting over a cold, and I seem to have spoken too soon on that front. The cold had other ideas, but I'm pushing through. But apologies if my voice sounds a little congested. I'll do my best to mute my mic when sneezing or nose blowing, but there will be some of that.
All right, it's way to power through.
Thanks. But I've got a cup of tea, and more importantly, we've got an interview that I'm very, very excited about. So our guest today is Jamal Hansen, which is not a name that I expect anyone to know, but Jamal has some extraordinary stories from a corner of the poker world that, in all my time playing poker, I've heard virtually nothing about. According to Jamal, there's actually quite a lot of poker being played in this space. It's being played under really unique conditions, and I'm so glad that we can bring you this peek into such a fascinating but rarely seen corner of the poker world. The space that I'm talking about is prison. Jamal played poker in prison. He played a lot of it, and he played for a lot of money. You probably have questions about the logistics of that. Don't worry, Jamal will explain all of that for you. But first, I want to give you a little background on how the interview came to be. One of my coaching students, Michael Lissman, who's also a listener to this show, he met Jamal by chance. The two of them started talking about poker, and Michael was really blown away both by the stories that Jamal had to tell and also just by Jamal's ability to tell a story. Michael told Jamal about the podcast, he got Jamal's business card, and he encouraged me to call him, which I did. There's another wrinkle to this story, though, and it's something that made me feel more comfortable about inviting Jamal onto the show, right? Obviously, people tell a lot of stories when it comes to poker. We wouldn't ordinarily just, you know, take some random guy that a listener happened to meet and say, oh, he's got some good stories, let's bring him on the show. In Jamal's case, there's actually an article in the Washington Post about him that confirms a lot of the details of what is, even setting aside the poker part, a pretty amazing story. Jamal was arrested as a teenager for selling a relatively small amount of crack, but the drug laws at the time were quite harsh when it came to sentencing for crack cocaine specifically, and Jamal ended up getting 22 years in prison. While in prison, Jamal essentially taught himself law, wrote a lot of his own briefs, did a lot of his own legal advocacy. As you'll see, he's a very, very smart guy. Congress eventually acknowledged that the disparity between punishments for crack cocaine versus powder cocaine were excessive and discriminatory. And they changed those laws, but they didn't apply those changes retroactively. So, you know, Jamal had essentially already served the amount of time that he would have served had he been convicted under the newer laws. And he ended up having his sentence commuted by an executive order. We talk a bit more about this towards the end of the interview. He explains this better than I do. But I'll also link the Washington Post article in the show notes if you want to get the full story there. One other thing to say about this interview, Jamal is a professional driver, and he's driving during this interview. He assured us that it was a hands-free phone. Still, this is not ordinarily the conditions under which we would prefer to do our interviews for a variety of reasons. There's background noise. There's the risk that maybe he gets distracted by driving. There's the even bigger risk that maybe he's not distracted by driving when he should be. So ordinarily, this is not something that we would do. But even more so than with most of our guests, I felt like we were lucky that Jamal was even giving us the time of day. You know, he had no idea who we were. There's nothing he was trying to promote, nothing really in it for him at all to do this podcast. And so I didn't really feel like we had any leverage to reschedule when we found out that that he was going to be driving. Thankfully, it ended up going well, except, well, Nate, I guess you end up taking kind of ill during the interview and had to cut out early. But other than that, it went well.
I had a disagreement with a tuna sandwich. Yeah. We resolved the disagreement and parted ways amicably.
Jamal did share some great stories with us. We're really grateful to him for sharing those stories, and we hope that you will find them as fascinating as we did.
Things here are always changing.
Hello, this is Sean Lango, editor of the Thinking Poker Podcast. If you've been listening to recent episodes, then you may know that the band that brings you the music for this show is about to bring some new music to the world. My friend Gina and I are in the process of releasing our first album on vinyl with our new band, Soft Center. Our Kickstarter campaign to raise money for our self-release is almost at its goal, but we only have 2 days left. If you've enjoyed any of the music you heard on this show, please do give us a visit over at our Kickstarter and check out what we have going on over there. Find out more at www.softcenter.band. Not .com, but .band. Thanks so much.
Our strategy sponsor is Tournament Poker Edge. At Tournament Poker Edge, you'll find hundreds of hours of poker strategy videos from dozens of instructors, including me. My latest series is a unique one. I started recording live while I was playing online during the World Championship of Online Poker, which, you know, I almost never make these videos live, but I actually ended up winning one of the tournaments that I was playing. So, you know, it ended up being a cool thing to have recorded, and now you'll have access to my real-time in-game thought processes on my way to victory when you sign up at tournamentpokeredge.com. Our strategy hand is coming to us from Jeff. Jeff says this is from a 2-3 no-limit hold'em game, nine-handed. I've just recently sat down and have yet to play a hand. There's a $6 straddle. Folds to me in middle position. I raise to $17 with King of Diamonds, Queen of Hearts. The button calls and the straddle calls. I have $300. This is the first hand I played. They both have me covered, so effective stacks are $300. Anything to talk about so far?
I'd make it 20. 17's fine, but yeah, I'd go a little bit bigger.
Yeah,
that's just me.
I think this, people don't always fully account for those straddles. I mean, you're essentially playing a 2-3-6 game now, so you know, $17 might seem like a large raise for a 2-3 game, and you know, it would be a large raise for a 2-3 game, but for a 2-3-6 game, it's at, you know, 2-3-6 is actually a somewhat bigger game even than 3-6 would be. So yeah, I agree with Nate. A slightly larger preflop raise might be desirable, but pretty minor point.
Yeah, and you don't want to bloat the pot with a hand like King Queen, but also you do want to shorten the effective stacks with a hand like King Queen. So, I mean, you want to pick one size, I think, and make it that size with all your raising hands. But I do think that the bigger size should help King Queen specifically.
Well, yeah, and when you're only 50 big blinds effective, I mean, you mostly want to be raising hands that kind of look like King Queen, you know.
Yep.
So the flop is King of Hearts, Jack of Clubs, Six of Diamonds. Are here again holding King of Diamonds, Queen of Hearts. So top pair, pretty good kicker. Straddler checks. Sorry, were you going to say something?
Yeah. Can I say one more thing about preflop? Yeah. Now that I think about it, is you know, I think we have some people who listen to the show who sometimes write in and say that they like what we do, but it's a little bit advanced. And since you mentioned that it's a, you know, a straddled pot, I think it's worth saying that King Queen is the sort of hand that you do still want to raise, even though it's straddled. It's an offsuit hand. It's in some sense a reverse implied odds hand, but it is a very strong hand. And I think some people would be tempted just to limp it, given the higher stakes of the straddled pot, and they wouldn't want to put like $20 in the pot with King Queen offsuit, which they think of as a reverse implied odds hand or just some sort of dangerous hand in a 2-3 game. And I think it's worth pointing out that you still want to be raising that hand. You know, it's just the stakes have been raised. You're playing a bigger game. King Queen plays perfectly well, and it's very much a raising hand. And just because you're putting more absolute money in the pot doesn't mean that makes it a bad play or you're doing anything wrong. Conversely, you're unusually likely to put hundreds of dollars in the pot with a hand like one pair, which you might not be used to doing, but that's them's the breaks, right? And you've got a good opportunity here.
Yeah, that's kind of what I meant with the you know, that this is really now a 2-3-6 game, right? That straddle, you know, has increased the stakes dramatically, more than doubled the stakes, right? There was previously $5 in the preflop pot. There's now $11 in the preflop pot. So you are playing a much bigger game than you were when you were playing 2-3. And I think, yeah, like you said, Nate, you need to take that into consideration.
Yeah. Gamble. We hit the flop.
The straddler checks, and our hero again holding King Queen on a King Jack 6 rainbow board. Hero bets $30 into the $50 pot. Button calls, straddler folds. Any thoughts on you're doing anything other than betting? Do you like the bet size?
Yeah, I like the bet. I think you should be expecting, I think your opponents should be expecting you to bet. I would certainly not disappoint them with this hand. There are a lot of worse hands they can call you with. There are hands that they will fold that you want them to fold. And if you check, I wouldn't expect the button drastically overbet. Like, I'm not sure he's gonna go ahead and bet ace nine or pocket eights or even like 8-7 for a three straight. I'm not sure he's gonna do that, so I would just go ahead and bet myself. I would probably start thinking about stacks and how big they are and how to get them in the middle. Usually you don't want to be putting in this much money with one pair, but as we said, it's straddled, so I think probably like 35 would be better than 30. I think you should get calls from all the hands you want to get calls from, including hands like jacks. Then if you get called in one spot, then it's 70 plus 50. There's 120 in the pot and like, you know, 240 left to be bet. You should be able to comfortably get that in by the river. And that's good. And if you're beat, probably at these stakes, your opponents will let you know about it at some point. So I would bet a little bit more just for value and for all the reasons one usually bets. But this bet size is not bad. What do you think?
I think the stack to pot ratio here is a touch awkward. So, you know, it's like 280-ish in the effective stacks and 50 in the pot. So we're looking at a stack to pot ratio of, you know, 5.5 to 1, something like that, which is a little more than is really the sweet spot for a top pair hand. This is kind of what we were talking about. We were saying you might want to raise a little bit more preflop. Is, you know, a lot of your hands that you're raising preflop at this stack depth should be the kinds of hands that when they connect with the board at all, when they get a favorable flop, they're often making one pair kinds of hands, whether that's because they're, you know, starting as big pocket pairs or because they're your two Broadway cards like King Queen. You're pretty frequently going to end up, you know, like this is the kind of flop that you're looking for, to, you know, flop top pair with a good kicker. And I think having slightly less money in the effective stacks is to your advantage here. I think some of the awkwardness of this hand comes from the fact that you're sort of like your hand is just kind of right on the threshold of good enough to be looking to get all in. I think that's part of the, you know, awkwardness with the sizing here. But I agree with Nate. You probably want to bet a touch larger here. This is also just what you might call an action flop, you know, with two Broadway cards on the board. There's just a good chance that people are going to put money in the pot. And I don't think it's a board that you want to be just continuation betting willy-nilly. So I think if you have like 8-7 of diamonds, this is the time to just check and give up. When you are betting here, you mostly should be betting either your strong hands that are happy to be building a larger pot, or betting relatively weak hands like ace-queen or queen-10 or something like that that are happy to generate some extra fold equity with large bets. But I think like your betting range in general will be happy here to make larger bets, and I think you can do that here. But again, I think it's a relatively minor point.
Yeah, and I think inflating the pot when you might not have position later, spoiler alert, is, you know, that has its downside. But also, if you're going to be getting into a river situation where you have one pair, it's nice to have a really small stack to pot ratio at that point, so you can actually get called by a worse hand and not raised. So that's one more reason to bet a little bit bigger, or to elaborate on what I was saying before.
So we end up getting the button calls and the straddle folds. We now go to the turn with $110 in the pot and 230 or so remaining in the effective stacks. 250 or so remaining in the effective stacks. And the turn is the nine of diamonds. So the board now is king, jack, 6-9. There are two diamonds on the board now, for what it's worth. I don't think that's terribly relevant, and the hero does have king, queen with the king of diamonds. Do you bet again here?
I would check. I think a lot of my range is checking here. I have... I think a lot of the hands that we fold out were way ahead of. If I check, I can evaluate, see what the opponent does. I no longer am happy about getting full stacks in. I think a lot of worse hands either improved or are no longer going to play with us. Meanwhile, worse hands might check or might bet if we check. And against a better player, if I was worried about balancing more, I think a lot of our range will check here. Like, we have a lot of like ace, king, queens, hands like that. Mm-hmm. Ace, jack, that would very happily check here. We will have some straights and some sets and some really good hands, but I think we can very happily put this hand into a checking range, and I think we should definitely have a pretty big checking range. So I would check. What would you do?
I like checking also. And I think even against a weaker player, I think there's a pretty good case for checking. The value I see in checking against a weaker player is that I think a lot of people are going to bet too much in the imposition player's shoes. Like, they might just kind of expect that you're always going to bet here when you have a hand like king, queen, ace, king, pocket aces. You know, many people are uncomfortable giving up the betting lead. And so I think what you might see is your opponent betting for no particularly good reason, betting hands like queen, jack, jack 10, king 10, that I think he really ought to be playing as checks, but I think he might just bet those. You know, people have this idea of just wanting to take down the pot, and it's something that I push back against pretty hard. You know, you probably heard me do it on the show before, that you really want to be thinking mostly in terms of, you know, what specific hands are you causing to fold when you bet, or are you going to be ahead of an opponent's calling range? You really want to be thinking in those terms when you bet, but I think there's a good chance that the button here is not going to do that, that the button is going to bet too much when checked to, including with many hands. So, I mean, that's sort of the disadvantage of checking, is you give them the opportunity to check back with some second best hands that would have called you, you know, hands like middle pair and a gut shot or top pair with a worse kicker. But I think that there's a good chance he's going to bet those anyway. And I actually am more interested in that than I am in just inducing a pure bluff. You know, I don't really know what it is that he would be just like purely bluffing with on the turn. So that's why I say, like, I think if we're checking and hoping for him to bet, what we're kind of hoping for is, frankly, a bad bet from him. More so than
it's been known to happen.
Right, exactly. I mean, maybe like ace queen or ace 10 are hands that he might have called the flop with, and then, you know, would just be like pure bluffs now. But so the really significant thing here is that the most obvious draw, queen 10, gets there on the turn. I think the majority of the villain's range is going to be king x, jack x, or queen 10 for calling the flop. And it's kind of difficult when the really obvious draw gets there. You know, many people are just, even no matter how much they want to bluff, they're just not going to have a lot of hands that are good bluffing candidates. And I think what we might see is the opponent inadvertently, you know, trying to bluff with a hand like queen jack or jack 10 without even really thinking of it in those terms. They're just thinking that he's trying to like take the pot down, and that's certainly to our advantage if we're going to play against those kinds of hands.
Yeah. One other kind of hand that we should think about is 7-6 suited, the occasional 7-6 offsuit, and like ace-6 suited. I think those are bad flop calls, like pretty wretched flop calls, in fact, but yeah. Especially since we bet a little bit smaller on the flop, and also because a lot of people do not drive all the way to casino to make speculative pre-flop calls, hit the flop, and then fold for one bet. It's not really right in the game plan. We should put some of that in their range. And I think people also have like a latent awareness that those hands are not really great flop calls, even though they hit the flop. And it's like, oh well, I floated and now I'm betting. So I think you'll see that a little bit more than one might expect.
Yeah, well said. Jeff says, I thought for a bit and checked. My main concern was if I faced a raise on this board from an unknown opponent, I felt it better, therefore, to pot control with my one just a little higher hand. I don't think I'd feel comfortable getting an all-in on the turn with this board and no knowledge of my opponent. The button quickly bet $60 into $110. After just a little thought, I call. Sounds like we were both planning on calling after checking, so we're in agreement this is a correct call?
Yeah, I wouldn't call any bet, but the bet size means that even if I'm behind, if we're behind, we're not getting our price, but it's also not a complete disaster because there are hands that will almost certainly give us the winner, and there will also be hands that cause the opponent to shut down and fail to value bet us on the river. or fail to bluff us off the pot on the river. Mm-hmm. So that's that. So just the price is good. You know, he bet just a little bit more than half the pots. We're getting just a little bit worse than 3-1. So that's a really good price with our hand. And also, as we discussed, it's very, very easy. Not very, very easy. But especially if our opponent is going to make sometimes, it's really quite easy for us to be ahead here. Maybe not more than half the time, but I'd say we're ahead here 40% of the time.
Mm-hmm. That sounds about right.
Yeah.
Not to mention you've got the gut shot draw as well. So
as we're saying, yep.
Even when you're not ahead, you've got a bit of an opportunity to improve.
Yep. And if the button's quickly betting, you know, sometimes that's going to be a better hand. But I don't think the physical information makes me really worried that he's got you beat. You know, I think sometimes if he's got like a weak two pair or even a hand like ace king, then he might bet quickly with those hands. But I wouldn't interpret that as strong. If anything, I would make his range slightly weaker in light of the fact that he's betting quickly.
Hmm. The one thing I want to say here is, you know, Jeff mentioned the concept of pot control. And I mean, I think there are a lot of reasons to check the turn. I think he's right. I think he's certainly right that you don't want to bet and get it in on the turn. If anything, I would be planning on folding to a raise, but I don't really love that either. But I think pot control, I mean, the idea behind pot control is that you're going to keep the pot small. And that's not really something you can do from out of position. And it's not really something that you can do when the stack to pot ratio is already 2, right? Like, yeah. If your opponent wants to put all the money in here, he's going to put all the money in here. So I think that, I mean, and it may just be that Jeff is kind of throwing that term out there, but I just find people are you're kind of way too focused on the idea of pot control when, especially when out of position. It's not up to you whether a bet goes into the pot. When you're in position, you can check behind, and now we want 100% certainty no bet goes into the pot on the turn. That's pot control. That's guaranteeing that no bet goes in the pot on the turn. When you're out of position, often what you're doing is just guaranteeing that a bet only goes in when your opponent wants it to, right? So what you're really doing is giving control of the pot to your opponent. As I say, I do like Jeff's check here. I just, he sort of hit a trigger for me with mentioning pot control.
I mean, you can, like, even when you're out of position, you can, you know, control in some sense the size of the pot. You can do things that affect the size of the pot.
The opportunity to raise you,
but the thing I want to attach neon lights to is the fact that we have an SPR of 2 with 2 betting streets to go. So there are 2 less than pot sized bets to get all in, and there are 2 betting streets left. So that train has left the station. Like the stacks are in play. Stacks are in play. The only question is what you do given that stacks are in play. If there were $500 behind, then checking has the added benefit of making it harder to you know, put your whole stack at risk with a marginal one pair hand. But the time for that is past. We bet the flop. The pot's too big for that. And the only question is how to behave now that stacks are in play. And it's still the check, but not to control the pot.
Yeah. The river is the 10 of spades, making the final board. King, jack, 6, 9, 10. Our hero holding king, queen. Jeff says, well, that's a sweet river. Now, how do I play it? I actually thought for about 30 seconds before acting. I wasn't Hollywooding. I was really trying to figure out what he would call a bet with. Should I bet small just to get some payoff? Bet large to look bluffy? The problem was, I thought that the longer I tanked, the more it looked like I was Hollywooding with a queen if I then bet. So finally, I decided to check. My thought was if he had a strong enough hand to call a bet, then he had a strong enough hand to bet if I don't represent the queen. I can also induce bluffs since I checked the turn and river. How do you like that thinking?
I think Jeff, is that our correspondent's name? Jeff? Sorry. Yes, yeah, Jeff. I think Jeff played a lot of streets of this pot well. I don't think this is one of them, and here's why. I think it's really to Jeff's credit that he made his thinking explicit. I just think that some of the things he says are false. So my thought was, if he had a strong enough hand to call a bet, then he had a strong enough hand to bet if I don't represent the queen. Again, the way to get better is to make your thoughts explicit, and then subject those thoughts to scrutiny. And here, I think if we subject this thought to scrutiny, we will find that it is false. So I think that your opponent will often at these stakes, and at any stakes really, shut down if he doesn't have a queen. But he can bluff catch. There should be plenty of two pair hands in his range. Like a lot of his hands hit two pair on the river. And a lot of his hands just don't have a queen in them. We did talk about him betting hands like queen jack on the turn, and that's totally in his range. And he could even have ace queen too, but he can also have a lot of hands that are just like jack nine or jack 10 or 10 9 or a hand like 7-6. Now, 7-6 is a hand that you let him bluff with that will definitely not call a bet, but many of those other hands will at least think about calling, and but will almost certainly not bet if you check. I think that especially with the four liner being on the board, I think a lot of opponents just aren't going to bluff into that, even if they should. It's just not a situation where you see as much bluffing as is optimal. So I just don't think it's true that hands that will call will bet themselves. That's true sometimes. I think it's not true here. And similarly, when Jeff says, I can also induce bluffs since I check the turn and the river, again, that's a very reasonable sort of heuristic for bluff induction. Like when you show weakness twice in a row, that's often a green light for your opponent. But here I think the four liner will discourage the opponent from bluffing, given the action and given the stakes. So that's that. I think Jeff is correct that the longer you wait before betting, the less it looks like a bluff. Like if your opponent's reflective, he'll probably think that he doesn't see people tank for a long time and then bluff this river with this action. I think that's correct, but A, that doesn't mean that betting isn't still your best option, and B, that's all the more reason to prepare well before the river and between streets and so on. I think you need to bet this river. I would probably just move all in, because that's probably what I would do if I was bluffing. And that's that. Maybe you get paid off, maybe you don't, but you should have a lot of hands that do not have straight on this river. And yeah, I think it's going to be hard for him to put you on a pure bluff. Like if you're bluffing, you're turning a hand into a bluff, given that you checked and called a significant bet on the turn. But that's possible. Like you do see people, you know, playing ace jack this way or something sometimes. Like if you had ace jack, what would you do? You should consider bluffing, I think. So I would bet. I think all in is a good bet size. I think a smaller bet to try to get paid off by two pair is also perfectly defensible, you know, bet calling. So that's that. What do you think?
I want to expand on what you said about you making your thought process explicit, because I think you're right that Jeff is doing a good job of that. And I think to take that a step further, you want to get more explicit when you say, you know, the hands that are going to call the bet. Okay, what are those hands? Like, enumerate those hands. When you say he might be bluffing, with what? Enumerate what exactly those bluffing hands might be. And I think that'll be helpful to reach some of the conclusions that Nate and I are reaching here, that, for instance, it's going to be kind of difficult for the villain to hold a hand that would want to bluff in this situation. As you know, if we stretch, we can find some, right? You said maybe 7-6 suited, maybe ace 10 is weak enough that he decides to turn that into a bluff. But I mean, it would have to involve him turning a pair of some sort into a bluff. It's really hard for him to get to the river with nothing. And you know, this, I'm sure I've said this on the air before, but you know, people just do this so commonly where they just say, you know, it could be a bluff. Right, and you know, a bluff is not a hand. Right? A hand consists of two cards. So, and I think it's very helpful to try to specify what hands exactly would want to bluff that the villain could actually have, given the actions that he's taken on previous streets. And so, yeah, I think that idea of checking to induce a bluff is for those reasons, as you said, Nate, I think not great. I do also think there's a problem that the hero might have some trouble finding bluffs of his own that he wants to bluff with, like hands that would check call the flop, check call the turn, and then now want to turn into a bluff on the river. The truth is, though, you don't need that many of them. I mean, in terms of what queen X you can have, it's probably just king, queen, and maybe jack, queen. I'm not even sure that I would want to play jack, queen this way. So I don't know that I'm really going to have a lot of queen X in my range. If we're only talking about how do I balance, you know, 12 combinations of queen X for a pot-sized shove on the river, you're not going to need a whole lot of combinations of bluffs to do that. You're only going to need six combinations of bluffs, even to balance out a pot-sized bet if you only have 12 combinations of value. So it's really not that hard to find bluffs, even for relatively large bets, if you're even concerned about being balanced in this situation at all. You know, I think there's also good reason to believe that your opponent, you know, probably will not do hand reading of that level of sophistication to say, oh, it's kind of difficult for this guy to show up with a bluffing hand after he checks and calls the turn. Like, he'll probably do the same kind of thing that Jeff did and just say, well, it could be a bluff. And, you know, a lot of your opponents are just going to make the decision based on their own two cards. And if he has a set, if he has two pair, you know, he might just call without really giving much consideration to how easy or hard it's going to be for you to actually find bluffs. He's just, you know, gonna play his cards. But I agree with Nate that I don't think he's very likely to bet those hands when checked too. I actually think of I quote it all the time, and I'm sure I've quoted it on the show before, but Gareth Chandler's famous line that most people aren't playing poker; they're playing a different game called "Do I Have the Best Hand?"
Yeah,
and you know, you'll see people bet before the river for protection, but you very rarely see people make thin value bets on the river, right? They'll bluff the river if they're sure they don't have the best hand. They'll value bet the river when they're sure they have the best hand. I think you tend not to see people, you know, trying to value bet hands like Jack 10 or 10-9 here, and for good reason. I mean, I don't know what really he'd expect to be getting called by when he bets 10-9. I mean, I think there's good reasons for him not to bet 10-9 here, but yeah, I think you want to do your own value betting in this and in most situations.
That's well said. Can I suggest some live shenanigans if you want some live shenanigans? Yeah. So let's say that you're in a position where you're in an unexpected situation. Maybe you didn't have all the options, you know, all the possibilities in mind going into the river. So you just have tanked for 30 seconds and you don't know what to do about it. And you're worried that a bet would look strong. I think that against some opponents, betting like $20 can be really, really nice here. So like, if you think about how that looks from your opponent's perspective, like you raise pre-flop, you bet the flop, then all of a sudden the river comes in, the four liner's on the board, and you bet like a seventh of the pot, less than that, like a tenth of the pot, then it looks like you really just don't want to get raised. So he might bluff raise you, but he also might just pay off with an utterly hopeless hand like 6-5. And that can get you $20 that you wouldn't have gotten otherwise. I don't think it's the best play standardly. I would not do it all the time, but it is something that should be in your bag of tricks, especially if you make the sort of suboptimal play of tanking for 30 seconds on the river. Then it can be nice, I think.
Yeah, this strikes me as one of those situations, you know, people never want to make small bets on the river because or if they do make small bets and then they get raised, they're always so afraid that they've induced a bluff. Like, oh, what if he's raising me just because I bet small? You know, this is a good opportunity if you really believe that small bets are going to encourage your opponents to raise you, which I'm a little more skeptical of, but I mean, it certainly does happen. This is a nice opportunity to do kind of like a fake blocking bet. Yeah. And I can imagine wanting to do a real blocking bet here if you had, say, Jack 10 or something like that. Actually, even Jack 10 is probably too weak. King 10, maybe, is a hand that I might want to do this with, where I would be planning on folding to a shove.
Yeah, and I'm not saying it's the best play. I do think it's like strictly better than checking, though. So that's...
This maybe doesn't count as shenanigans, but I also think sometimes in live games, particularly with inexperienced players, all-in bets get overly much respect. So you might find that a bet of, you know, $150 instead of $193 will get you more than 75% of the calls that $193 would get you.
Yeah.
Just because people are all-in just doesn't look as strong to people, or it looks overly strong to people.
Yep.
Results. Jeff says, after very little time, after very little time, the opponent cut out $120 and moved it forward. I waste no time and move my remaining $193 into the middle, announcing all in, and he snap folds. The fact that he didn't even think twice for a small all-in raise made me think he was really weak or just bluffing. He was betting very quickly, trying to show strength, which we all know what that means, right? Yeah, I mean, that's probably true. I think probably, I mean, and this kind of gets to the point of why I don't like checking in the first place, which is that I think it just in general, when he bets, he probably either has a queen or nothing. And so, you know, he's, yeah, his decision is going to be trivial when you raise. Like, I just don't think he's betting the kinds of hands that are going to have decisions when facing a raise in the first place. And you may have gotten lucky to find, you know, one of the rare bluffing hands. I guess with that logic, it doesn't really matter how long you take to move your stack in. But, you know, I do think it looks very strong in this situation if you just, like, instantly move all in.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I if it's true that he just always has a queen or a bluff, then it doesn't really matter. But for what it's worth, I think, you know, that it's hard to imagine you ever have anything other than a queen when you just, like, snap move all in after he bets 120.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, you didn't cost yourself any money here, but I think probably 3 to 5 seconds is the best amount of time to wait.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, don't waste everyone's time inordinately, but it does look very strong when you do that.
Well, and also, like, it's obnoxious to Hollywood too long here, but it also looks just very, very strong if you tank for a long time and then move all in.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Good. So thanks for writing, Jeff. Nice hand.
Yeah. Shall we go talk to Jamal?
Let's go talk to Jamal.
So first off, Jamal, thanks so much for making the time for us. I guess let's start. I mean, you want to give people a little background. You know, where are you from? Who are you? How'd you get started playing poker? That kind of stuff.
My name's Jamal Hansen. I'm born and raised in the Washington D.C. area. Mm-hmm. My introduction to poker, I probably would have to say, happened when I was maybe 16, 17 years old. I know I was in college when I first got introduced to poker, so I know I was at least 16 years old.
And, so you were in college when you were 16?
Yes.
Wow.
I graduated from high school early. I don't know if the guy that put you in contact with me, I kind of shared my story with him.
He didn't tell me much.
I don't know how much of...
He just said that you were interesting and we would enjoy talking to you.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, I just didn't know how much he had shared with you.
No, I'd say you should assume we know nothing.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, a little backstory. I graduated high school early. Went away to college at 16 with a double degree in accounting and business finance. Mm-hmm. By 19 years old, I was serving my first prison sentence. You know, at 19, it's kind of hard to stay on that straight and narrow path and take that 10-year plan when you can get $10,000 to $15,000 a week in the street.
Right.
Ultimately, it was the dumbest decision I ever made in my life. You know, at that age, you don't have the wherewithal to know that at that time. Mm. And so, yeah, by the time I was 19, I was serving my first prison sentence. And that was my first experience with prison poker. Mm-hmm. Picked up the game in college. Started playing recreationally in prison. Probably
before you,
age 19, 20. For real small stakes, though. Real small stakes. Mm-hmm.
Well, and even before you went to prison, weren't you telling me there were already some NBA players you were playing with?
Okay, now, hold up. Wait a minute.
All right. Sorry, I don't want to get ahead of you.
I'm giving you the before.
Okay, I'm sorry.
This is before I met them.
Okay.
This is my first stint in prison.
Okay.
I was 19 years old when I went to prison the first time. When I came home, I was 22.
Oh, okay. So the first time in prison is when you really got started playing poker.
Right. Okay. It's when I started playing recreationally and started, you know, really looking at the game. And I came home, like I said, thought I knew a lot. Used to socialize with a couple NBA players, and we would get together on the weekend sometime, and I would trim them out a decent amount of money. So I really thought I knew what was going on with the game.
Right.
Until I got locked up the second time. And, you know, my first prince was in a state. It was in a state facility. Mm-hmm. My second prison sentence was a federal sentence. And make no mistake about it, at that time when I first got incarcerated in the federal system, different kind of inmate in the feds as opposed to the state. You were meeting individuals that, you know, were well-traveled, and from all walks of life that all knew the game of poker. Many different walks of life. Some in the financial world got busted for fraud cases. Some were, of course, in there for what I was in for distribution of narcotics. I mean, but you had individuals that were in there for a multitude of reasons, all sitting down at the table, and the commonality was the game of poker. And I'm one of those individuals who feel as though I can match wits with the best of them. And I was willing to sit down in a game that probably I had no business sitting down in. And let's just say over the course of about 4 to 6 weeks, I think I probably lost about, 12 to 15 grand. And in prison, that's a lot of money. That's a lot of money. And like I explained to you when we talked previously, I put a call in to a relative to have them move the money around for me so I could pay my debt. Because not paying your debt in prison is a real, real, real big issue.
I can imagine.
That could result in, not just trouble for you, but trouble for you and everybody who you associate with that's from where you're from. So, I put the call in, and of course, she do it. And she said, well, look here. I mean, I know this is your money. But I know you're not getting extorted. I know my son. I know you're not getting extorted. She said, I know you don't use hard drugs. So the only other thing that you could be doing in there to be moving this kind of money around is you're gambling. And whatever you're gambling at, you're no good at it. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to put $3,000 on your books. And that should hold you for about 6 months. And I don't want you calling me for another dime. And what that did was it just forced me on the sidelines for a while to really, really reassess my game. And not only that, put a watchful eye on the individuals that I was in the game with. I mean, because sometimes when your attention and your focus is diverted other places, you may miss some things that you should have seen, if you get what I'm saying. Sometimes the hand is a little quicker than the eye, but when I'm on the sidelines and I get to focus intently on the game and not be involved in the game, just be an observer, I got a chance to really focus in on the guys that I was playing with. One, to make to ascertain whether or not I was in a fair game. Right. That's one. And then two, to pick up on some of the psychological aspects of the game. Because obviously I was missing a whole lot because I was losing a lot. And, you know, the number one thing I realized was I wasn't folding enough hands. I think we discussed that. And secondly, man, I just got a chance to read a little body language and pick up on a few tail signs and things of that nature. And then, you know, I paid. When I say I paid, not only did I pay with my losses, but I invested with my time. I paid a guy who had a cell that his cell was situated right in front of the television, in front of the ESPN TV. And so I paid a guy to switch cells with him so I could move into his cell so that I could be in front of the ESPN TV so that when the World Series of Poker, so when the World Series of Poker is on at night, I could be up studying. Hand over hand over hand over hand.
Wow.
Just to increase my odds with the guys that I was playing against. I mean, I went to school for accounting and business finance. Numbers has always been my thing. So if I could sit there and watch the percentages time and time and time again, over time you commit them to memory. And when you see the hands, you can assess your percentages in the hand moving forward and pretty much ascertain if it's a good fold or not. I mean, every now and then you get a cowboy and you go hard. But I mean, for the most part, you could play strategic poker and get a slight advantage over the next individual that may know a little less than you.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what happened. And so gradually, I crept back into the game and got a little better. And I ended up getting transferred to a facility up in Pennsylvania. And initially, we had a little small game going. You know, my thing really was sports betting at that time. But we had a little small game going, and one of the guys approached us prior to us getting the game started, and he was like, "Man, listen here. I think we got a whale that just hit the compound." And so, of course, you know, my ears perk up like a dog. I'm like, "What do you mean?" He said, "Yeah, man, I think we got a big fish on the compound. I got him in the head-up game right now, and I got him down about 10 or 15,000. So, of course, I can't believe this. I mean, it's not that often. There's plenty of guys in the feds that got that kind of money. Don't get me wrong. It's not a lot of guys that's in the feds that's willing to part ways right. with that kind of money. You feel me?
I do. I'm a little curious. So, I mean, what's this guy's incentive? Like, if he's already playing the fish heads up, what's his incentive for telling you about it?
Because here's the thing. When you got a fish like that on the hook, right?
Mm-hmm.
If he gets to a point where he feels like there's no way he can beat you head up, essentially what you did was pull the hook out the fish's mouth and let him swim away.
I see.
You get it?
I got it.
Yeah.
But if you get him in a game and there's a camaraderie established, and he wins a few hands, he loses a few hands. He wins some days, he loses more days than he wins. If he get down a little bit, if he has any type of ego and pride, he's going to want to fight against that group to get that money back.
Mm-hmm.
Man, that's the psychology of man. No one wants to just give it away. But, I mean, you're not going to sit there and go toe-to-toe in the ring with Mike Tyson and your Floyd Mayweather. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That one-on-one battle just don't interest you when you feel like you have no win. But you feel like if you can get inside the game, it changes the cards up a little bit. You feel like you maybe got a better chance of winning.
Right, so he needed you to kind of keep the game going.
So he brings, you know, to me. So first and foremost, you know, I want to sit and watch the one-on-one game. I'm going to sit and watch the one-on-one game just to see if this is really, really a fish or if it's just a minnow.
Yeah.
But the guy said it was a whale. So I go sit and I watch the game.
Hey, can I ask a question about this real quick?
Sure. And I'm going to give you... Go ahead.
In this spot, was there any chance you were the mark? You said you needed to watch the game. One reason to watch the game is that you never know how big a fish this guy is. Like, did you trust the other guy enough? Was there any chance that you were getting played?
Well, here's the thing. The guy who bought it to me, right?
Yeah.
It's funny, and this right here, you probably get a laugh out of this. It's because when he first came to the compound, he was the fish. He came to the compound because he had a couple dollars and he was fresh in. And he came to the compound thinking that he could play bully poker. And what I mean by bully poker is he thought because he had pretty long money in comparison to most of the guys that's in prison that was playing at that game, he just would bet them out of most hands. I mean, and instill the kind of fear in them with the bet that I often seen guys fold a locked hand. And I mean, you know, of course that's amateurish, but when you betting the kind of money that guys really, really can't afford to lose, in a month and you're betting it all in one hand,
mm-hmm.
that can discombobulate some guys. I mean, I'm being honest with you. Like I told you, the average person in prison makes probably less than $30 a month. So unless you came in with a lot of money, or you got a real, real good support system, or you got a mean hustle in prison, you don't have that kind of money coming in to just watch it go out like that. And so this guy came to the compound and thought that he could just push guys around with the money. So I assembled a couple of guys that I know had a couple of dollars, and we put together a game. And I knew it would attract him. He would come, and he would do what I knew he would do. He would just come to the table and throw money around.
Mm-hmm.
So what you do is you just fold. You fold, you fold until you get dealt a pat hand. And then when he throw his big money in there, then you back raise him, and he was one of those guys that had an ego problem. If he would look at your stack and size your stack up. And if when he made that first initial bet, if you just show the slightest bit of hesitation to call the bet, the very next bet he was going to put you all in. I don't care what you had in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
And he did that. And I came up on about $8,000 to $10,000 on him doing that. And once he lost enough, he wanted to break the game down and make it back to a gentleman's game again. The game had got out of hand. And once he saw that we were preying on him and that we were fold, and just wait for a pat hand, then he realized, I can never get my money back from these guys.
Mm.
Because they won't play reckless poker with me, and that's the only way I can get my money back.
Mm.
So when he realized he couldn't get it back, when this next guy hit the compound, and it's about maybe 3 or 4 months later, this next guy hit the compound, he beats the guy out about $15,000. And, man, after that, we introduced him to the game. When the guy quit him and wouldn't play him one-on-one, we introduced him to the game. And once he got introduced to the game, it was like, it's crazy how things can happen, but the guy who I was just explaining to you, who was the first fish, he got into the other guy's head like, we the two big guys with all the money. Those are the little guys who really can't afford to sit down and gamble here with us. And so we're going to break them, we're going to get them in debt to a point where they can't pay, and then we're going to see what they really made of when we get them in a position where they down so much that they can't pay. Because everybody on the compound is looking at them like they are, you know, good men.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens to these men that look like good men, and we get them in a position where they owe so much money they can't pay? So he made it to the other guys if it was an us against them type of thing going on. But really, the game was every man for himself. You see what I'm saying? But that was his way of keeping the guy at the table so that he can get some of his money back.
Yeah.
And, man, bro, if I really, really, really discussed the figures with you, you probably wouldn't even believe it. I mean, if I told you the figures, I mean, it literally was like a World Series of poker.
I mean, I know you mentioned the problems related to, you know, getting in a spot where you're not able to pay. Did you ever worry about other people not being able to pay you, or what you were going to have to do if people weren't paying you?
No, because here's the thing, man. I told you. Well, at least I thought I explained to you. All right. How we do it, right? Mm-hmm. How the game was run?
Mm-hmm.
Initially, the game was run week to week, right? And the first couple weeks, I don't think nobody at the table lost more than maybe $3,000. Nobody at the table lost more than $3,000,
mm-hmm.
except for this new guy. Now, here's the thing. I'm going to give you one name. This is the only name I'll probably give you because the others I got to kind of protect.
Sure.
But the reason why I'm going to give you guys this name is because when you Google this guy, then everything that I'm telling you will have validity because when you see the type of money that this guy's playing with,
okay,
then you'll know that the numbers that I'm giving you is peanuts to him.
Okay.
All right. Okay, so the guy's name is Rodney Morrison. Either one of you got access to a computer right now?
Yeah, I'm in front of a computer right now. This is Rodney Morrison.
Yep.
Cigarette magnate Rodney Morrison.
Cigarette magnate.
Okay, yep.
Do you see it?
I see it.
All right, well, I can tell you for sure, this is what I know because I've seen documents myself, that the U.S. government seized over $170 million in assets from
it. Wow.
And they weren't done. I mean, he had a soccer club over in Costa Rica, a resort. I mean, amazing wealth, bro. And I can tell you now, in prison, he was losing at that poker game that we speak of now. At one time, he was down probably over $2 million.
Jeez. What are the logistics? I mean, if you're able to talk about it, I mean, how are you settling up a debt like that? I'm sure you're not playing in cash.
Yeah. To be honest with you, yeah. Yeah. I mean, listen, man, if he owed you money, right?
Right.
If he owed you money, your people's get on the road, travel up to New York. He would put them up in the Waldorf Astoria or the Savoy Hotel, one of those real nice hotels.
Mm-hmm.
Have his security team meet him with a bank bag. Everything wrapped up.
Wow. So when you're actually playing, I mean, what are you using? Do you have access to chips, or what are you using to kind of play with, and then you keep track
all right,
of who knows what?
Now you gotta kind of get creative with that, right?
Right.
You gotta kind of get creative with that because one, you gotta make something that can't be duplicated, right?
Right. Yeah, you can't just be using foremost, you gotta have, forks or something.
Right. You can't use something that someone has easy access to.
Right.
You're going to find the material within the prison system that's kind of hard to, and then you'll take it and you'll make chips. Won't be no money, dollar amounts written on the chips, but everybody at the table knows what the chips are worth.
Right.
So, we might have had some rectangular shaped black cards. A material maybe they may have gotten out of Unicor or something that's hard to get. And then it may have had some type of stitching or insignia put on it.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll be a $10,000 car. You understand what I'm saying?
I do. That just seems crazy that you're essentially making your own $10,000 currency notes. I mean, crazy. It's impressive.
Yeah, I'm an advanced ceramics instructor. So I would go back there, engrave some pieces and fire them up and make some ceramics pieces and they're chips.
Wow.
But those chips might be $2,500 chips.
I mean, I guess people have to trust that you're not making extras for yourself then, right?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, because here's the thing. At all times, see that, and this is how you keep it fair. There's a chip count. On every last single chip, there's a chip.
Make sure that.
At any given time, any player at the table can say, let's call a chip count.
I see. So you make sure there's not anything extra circulating.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Before the game starts, we count all the chips that's in the game. Mm-hmm. And when the game ends, we count all the chips that's in the game. And the numbers got to match up.
Did you ever run into a spot where they didn't?
Nope. Because here's the thing. The person in the chips to the game is also responsible for making sure that the chips can't be reproduced.
I see. So
with me being an advanced ceramics, instructor, no one else has access to the kiln to fire up these pieces and carve them out and make these pieces.
So if there are extra chips, it's your problem.
You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, so it's your problem if there's extra chips.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. So I'd rather take on that task of making sure that the game is fit.
Right.
Than task that to someone else. You feel me?
Yeah. Do you get compensated for that at all? Or is that just, your compensation is getting to play the game?
Yeah, my compensation is getting to play the game. I mean, initially, when it was a much slower game, I housed the game. But when the big dollars got involved, what the hell we need a house for when it's only four of us playing and there's nobody else invited into this game? Who we need a cut for? We don't need nobody cutting the game.
Right.
At this point now, it's a gentleman's game.
Right.
May the best man win.
Now, I realize this might be something you can't talk about, but if you can, I imagine this wasn't something you were supposed to be doing. I mean, can you talk at all about how you were able to organize and play this game?
Yeah, I could talk about it. I mean, because at the end of the day, man, this is something that goes on in every institution across America, bro. Mm-hmm. Gambling is something that goes on in every institution. Every last single institution, federal and state, is gambling going on. And anybody tell you anything different than that, they're lying.
Well, I don't doubt it. I'm just curious how you pull it off.
Well, you pull it off is you show respect. It's not like the cops don't know what's going on. But if they come around, you may take your chips and put your chips. No, because we won't have them out open on the table like that. You know what I'm saying?
Okay.
Another way you keep things good between you and administration is you make sure that there's no confusion and hassles with your game.
Right, that it's not creating
problems. There's nobody checking in. Yeah, it's not creating problems for the institution.
Okay.
You don't got nobody trying to run over and shake the gate to try to check in and get into the hole for security reasons because they fear for their life because they can't pay their debt.
Okay.
See, long as you don't have that kind of stuff going on, then the administration is not going to bother you. They want you doing something that's going to keep you occupied, that's going to have you not getting into trouble. So if it's watching sports on TV, then okay, they'll allow the ticket man to put out a sports bet ticket for all the NFL games and the college football games so everybody can put their little 50 cent and their dollar bets in so they can have a reason to watch it.
Right.
Because if not, then you got a whole bunch of built-up hostility and you got guys ready to kill each other because they ain't got nothing else to do.
Right. So you got to make the game out an asset for the institution rather than a liability.
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely. Exactly. So if you do that, if you find a way to do that, and let's be real, man. They, at the end of the day, they're still men. And they understand that we're men. Even though we're men with a number that got to wear khakis, at the end of the day, we're men. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So let's keep everything in perspective. Right? Gambling is a 300 series shot. A disciplinary shot. Disciplinary infraction.
Mm-hmm.
So 300 series is like of the minor variety.
Okay.
Right? You tell a guy that got 22 years, another guy sitting at the table got, hear me out.
I hear you.
Another guy sitting at the table got 24 years. Another guy sitting at the table got double life. Another guy sitting at the table got 20 years. Man, you can't tell them what they can and can't do if it's not causing a security risk.
Right.
There's nobody life being threatened. There's no disorderly running of the institution. Man, this is just a quiet game amongst men.
Right.
And we're not bothering you. So like I told you, what happened was, I mean, because it's kind of hard to keep quiet because when you see a game like that going on, right?
Mm-hmm.
When it's $40,000 in a pot, $40,000 in a pot, and we're in prison, and the guy's making a decision on whether or not he should fold or call, man, you'll literally see a guy's forehead beat up with sweat and see the sweat drip down on the car.
Right.
You'll see the sweat drip down on the cars, bro. And I'm speaking in literal terms. Like,
I hear you.
It's not a hypothetical.
I hear you.
So when you got observers, right, you got observers who have never had this kind of money in their entire life, and they're watching a game where routinely pots get up to that much. Can you imagine the type of crowds that surround this kind of game?
I can only imagine.
So when the institution sees it, all right, so when the institution goes back and just for security purposes, check the cameras, and they see this large crowd gathering around this one table every day, all day.
Right.
What do you think is going to happen next?
Right. They know what's going on.
All right. So they come down. They got to come down.
Right.
They got to go check out what's going on. Then not only that. Man, this is prison, man. This is prison. So everything you do is pretty much under the microscope. And everybody talk. You know what I'm saying? So now it's being tossed around, the kind of bets that are being made at this table. So, of course, the captain and the warden, man, they don't want to believe nothing like that's going on. And first and foremost, you don't even believe it, period.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as a warden, he may make $120,000 a year. His captain might make, you know, a little bit less than that. And you're talking about a poker game where it's been pots that's been that much? Man, they can't believe that. I mean, literally, you're telling me that my whole year's salary has been won and lost in one pot?
Right.
I mean, as a warden or a captain, can you fathom something like that going on in your institution right up under your nose?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, hold up, fuck that. We got to go down there and we got to check this out.
Right.
So, of course it happens. Eventually it happens. So they come down. And when people see the warden and stuff coming down the walk, of course we get advance notice. Even the cops, the gym officers, the officers who run recreation,
mm-hmm.
they come over and they stand around. They don't want to give us a heads up that the warden is coming, but it's like us standing around should prompt you to want to clean up a bit. And of course it did.
Right.
So we move, we take everything down off the table. The inmates come and tell us, yo, the warden and the captain and, you know, upper management, man, they all coming this way. So we put everything away. And so warden, captain, AW, the assistant warden, they come into the little area where we were at, and they tell everybody to clear out. So it's just the three of us there. So we say, look, man, of course you know everybody on this compound talks. So we're hearing that you guys got this World Series of Poker going on down here. And the kind of numbers that we're hearing being tossed around is kind of like unbelievable. So of course you know we went and checked all your books out to see if any of you guys got any type of unusual funds being moved around through your accounts.
Right.
And actually, you're not doing it that way. We went through all of your phone records, and quite obviously, you're not doing it that way either. So however you're doing it, you're being smart about it. So we can't say you're doing nothing, so we're going to leave you alone. He said, but with that being said, ain't going to be no checking in. If you sit down here and you lose some money, you're going to pay it. You're not going to the hole. I'm not going to rescue you like that.
Mm-hmm.
Carry on. He said, seems to me you got an exclusive game going on, and you're not inviting outsiders into your game, which is a very smart thing. Man, carry on, gentlemen. And, man, we went back to business as usual.
I wanted to ask you about that, about other people joining the game. I mean, did that ever happen that somebody new wanted to play with you?
Of course individuals wanted to play, but, I mean, we can't vet them. How do we vet them? Mm-hmm. And who even wants to go into that when we already got,
you got a
private game going? We got a good thing going, man. You know, one more person to that might have complicated things.
Yeah.
So, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
What games are you playing? I mean, were you playing Texas Hold'em or Draw? Or, you know, what are you playing?
Texas. We play Texas Hold'em. We play Five Card Stud. Yeah, I mean, we can switch it up.
Mm-hmm.
We play Oklahoma. I mean, we play...
It was like Dealer's Choice or something? Or just if you change it depending
on... Yeah, all straight games, no. It was either Texas, Oklahoma, or... Five card stud or seven card stud. I mean, they were all basic poker games.
Mm.
No wild cards and none of that crazy stuff.
Can you say a little bit more about, you know, what kind of stuff you felt like you learned, you know, when you were observing these players and kind of getting better at poker, figuring out how you were going to beat them? I mean, what kind of things were you noticing, or what kind of things did you realize you had to do differently if you were going to start winning in this game?
Like I said, I had to pay more attention.
Mm-hmm.
I had to pay more attention, bro. You guys run a podcast, right?
Yeah.
So, I'm assuming that you're pretty serious poker players.
We are.
Right? So, I mean, it's not just about the numbers with you. You know, sometimes you play in the player.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, I realized I wasn't paying enough attention to the players to give myself that added advantage. Like this one guy, the guy that we're speaking of now that lost all the money, right?
Mm-hmm.
I told you, he had a tail sign when he had a pat hand. A tail sign.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, he had this thing where he would like look up and to the right and try to pretend as if he was confused, like he didn't really know what he had, like he couldn't really read the board.
Yeah, I've seen that one before. I've seen people do that, yeah.
And it was so deeply embedded in him that he couldn't even get rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because after I had beat him out of so much money to where I told you, he basically just came to terms with the fact that he was going to pay us to be his wet because he couldn't beat us.
Right.
And he didn't want the game to end because he didn't have nothing in common with anybody else on the compound. So I told him. Remember I explained to you the hand? I had him. He had me dead to right, and I told you I had second best. I had second best hand, and he did that little thing that I just explained to you,
mm-hmm.
And I knew that my kings were no good because I knew he had aces. Now, ordinarily. Man, I want to see those aces,
right,
if I got kings.
Right.
Ordinarily. I mean, and my predicated on some pot committed to this pot as opposed to what I got left in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
And that right there alone would make me see the aces. But when he did that thing, oh, nah, buddy. I flipped my kings over. And I said, now show me your aces. And he was like, man, if I didn't bring this fucking deck in here, I think you had this deck marked. He was like, man, there's no way you fold. He said, there's no way you fold those kings and those aces. There's no way. He said, but I bought this deck in here. I said, yeah, but man, you got this little thing you do, man, every time you got the best hand.
You told him?
He said, huh? Yeah, I told him. Yeah, totally. And then the thing of it is because I wanted to sit and watch what his response was going to be to me telling him. Because now he's going to sit and try to figure it out.
Right.
So now as he's sitting there trying to figure out what he's doing, look confused, now I know you got another pat hand. He's going to tell me something different, but it's going to mean the same shit.
Right.
So I'm playing psychological games with him now.
Right.
Man, and it's playing out to my favor. You feel me?
I got
so,
you.
So, those kind of things. I mean, I went to college. I mean, I'm not bragging or being boastful, but psychology 101, and studying Freud and some of the Freudian complexes and just understanding the psychology of man is beneficial in the game of poker.
Sure.
And anybody that's serious about the game of poker will say nothing to dispute that.
Any other examples you can think of? I mean, times where you were using psychology to get an advantage on somebody?
I mean, the other stuff is kind of like basic. I mean, like I bet people out of hands.
Mm-hmm.
I bet people out of hands. I mean, out of strong hands. I mean, they got second best, and I might just have nothing.
Right.
But I see what that pot is, and I'm willing to make a strong bet to buy the pot.
Right.
It don't always work. Sometimes they call me and back raise, and I got to let it go. But man, sometimes I'm just willing to trust my read.
Mm-hmm.
That he don't got the lock hand, and he's not willing to call his big bet to see if I got it. And I may have nothing, but sometimes I'm willing to bet a whole lot on nothing. And I've seen Phil Hellmuth do it a whole lot and win.
Mm-hmm. And I guess that's the advantage. You're playing with these guys day in and day out. You get to know them pretty well. You know their tendencies and whatnot.
Exactly. Then, I mean, some things... psychological is in relation to you just knowing a person's financial situation. If you know he really can't stand to lose a lot, man, you make him let him put the blind in, and then you let him see the flop. And when you know the flop didn't make nobody,
right.
No, it's nobody could have made a hand from the flop. All in. Huh? What'd you say? All in, man. Put all that shit to the middle of the table. Let's see who got the best hand. I'm willing to put all of it in. And you got some people that's like, man, this motherfucker, he wrecked, man, I ain't playing with him no more. I don't want to play no more.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, but you do things like that to get the advantage.
Right.
I'm not going to sit here and let you play lock hands all day and build your bankroll on me. And then it's going to be like pulling meat from a shark.
Right.
To get my money back. Nah, that's not going down like that. I'd rather play the psychological game with you than try to play this numbers game with you, because you know just as much about the numbers as I do. So I don't have no advantage in that department. So I got to go another angle.
So when you got out, I mean, I guess you lost an important source of income, actually, when you got out of prison, right?
Man, bro, I lost that source of income quite some time before I got out of prison.
Did you?
Because once I got serious about getting out of prison, I began to focus intently on things that was going to better myself and put me in position to succeed day one upon being released.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know if he told you this, but I'm a presidential commute.
Yeah, I read that the Washington Post article about you.
Yeah, so, I mean, like, this, my release was in the works for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
And bro, I was busy doing the work of preparing myself for release. I ain't had time to be focusing on no poker.
What did that look like? I mean, what was that work?
My background is in finance, but I was in the market.
Right.
So I had brokerage accounts set up with TD Ameritrade and Go Futures. So I'm trading futures contracts and U.S. stock options.
While you're in prison.
So when I'm not playing poker... Yeah, so when I'm not playing poker on the yard during the day, when the market closes at 4:30, I'm waiting on my closing numbers to come in over the computer so I can go analyze my charts, update my charts, analyze my charts, and stake my positions out for the market. So, like, that's really where my passion was at, really, was the market. I told you I'm a numbers guy.
Yeah.
So, you know, soon as I got out of prison, I went to the state comptroller's office and got incorporated and established my corporation and got my brokerage account set up, and I trade the market. I purchased some cryptocurrency. I'm not trying to, you know, go too far into it, but yeah, that's what I focus my attention on.
Okay. And
is that I came out first and foremost, I got myself enrolled in CDL training.
Mm-hmm.
So that I can give myself a viable means for employment.
Mm-hmm.
Selling drugs is no longer an option for me, man. I'm done with that life. You know what I'm saying? So I had to make sure that I had, you know, viable means for employment.
But,
and now I've established my own transportation company and, you know, I drive. So, I mean, what, I haven't got a, that question is, have I got a chance to play much poker since I've been home? Nah, not yet. It's coming, though, as I get a little bit more situated, because I'm the type of person, man, I don't do shit halfway.
Right.
When I go, I go all in. When I go, I go all in. So that may mean a 72-hour, week-long poker tournament, 20 hours out the day. Y'all know how that go.
Uh-huh.
Y'all know how that go. And I don't have the type of time right now to commit to that.
Right.
But as I get more and more situated and my financial situation improves greatly on the trajectory that it's on now, then of course I'm going to get back to it because I'm passionate about it. As you can see, the way I speak about it, you know I love it.
Yeah. Well, and you were doing a lot of your own kind of legal advocacy while you were in prison too, right?
Definitely. I filed a lot of my own briefs. I filed civil litigation against the federal government on my own. Back when Chris Christie was AUSA for New Jersey, I filed a federal lawsuit, tort claim against the Bureau of Prisons. And I prevailed against them on summary judgment, and they made me an out-of-court settlement. And because of the money that I had made on the poker table, I deemed that out-of-court settlement to be peanuts, and I turned it down and ultimately lost.
Wow.
In trial, but gained a plethora of knowledge and experience.
Yeah. What, I mean, how did you even, I guess you have access to law books while you're in prison. It just seems like a really daunting task to learn all that.
You say what?
It seems like a daunting task to take on to sort of, because I mean your background wasn't in law. You kind of had to teach yourself all that from scratch, right?
Yeah. All right. Here's the thing, bro. I got good reading comprehension skills. I'm not being boastful, but I got good reading comprehension skills. The only advantage that a person that went to law school has over me is that they had a law professor to explain to them what they was reading in the books. But I'm gonna tell you like this, man. Experience is the best teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Ain't no lawyer gonna fight harder for my freedom than I was. And the bad part about it is the part of the reason why I was in the predicament I was in was relying on incompetent attorneys. Because had my attorney done his job the way he was supposed to initially at the beginning stages of my case, the most I would have been exposed to was about 15 years.
And what did you end up getting? I mean, I know you got commuted, but what did you end up getting?
I got 22. I got 22 and a half years.
Wow. And that was just, it was for selling, I mean, it was a relatively small amount of crack that you had, right?
Yes, it was, but back then, the laws governing crack cases, man, was so stringent. I mean, they were hard, man, they were hard.
This was the 1990s?
And the crazy part about it, Clinton signed them into law.
Right.
And it had a devastating effect on our community.
Mm.
And, you know, you was getting heavily penalized for small amounts. For small, small amounts.
And that was the idea of the commutation, was essentially that your initial sentence had been overly harsh.
Oh, absolutely, man. I had already served. The thing was, when Congress admitted, when they openly admitted that the laws were racially biased and unjust, and then they repealed the law.
Right.
They repealed it. They took the laws off the books. Right. They changed the law. But what they didn't do was make those changes retroactively effective to guys like myself who were sentenced under the old law.
I see.
So we were stuck languishing in prison under laws that Congress had already deemed were unconstitutional.
Right.
Just because congressional members couldn't agree on a real big criminal justice fix.
Right.
They wanted to include everything in one bill.
And so you had already served the amount of time that you would have had to serve if you'd been convicted under the new laws.
I had already served. Right. I had served more than the amount of time than I would have been required to serve under the new laws.
Well, this has been really a fascinating insight into a part of the poker world that I knew basically nothing about. Is there anything else that you feel like we left out? Something I should ask you about that I didn't think of?
No, not really. I mean, this isn't going to be news to anyone that's inside of prison. Maybe the individuals who've never been inside prison.
Yeah, I think we got a lot of those.
The only thing that some guys that's been in prison may find surprising is the amount of money that was being, won and lost at the table. Mm-hmm. But, hey, there was a couple guys there that benefited. And, made a couple dollars and squandered a couple dollars in the process.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for taking and for sharing your story. I really found it absolutely fascinating.
Absolutely, man. Hope you guys enjoy the rest of your day.
Thanks. You too. Take care.
All right.
Devotion of a Carmelite, the fair passage of a bill, and who will sign us into law? I know you won't, you won't, you won't, you won't. Will you? You won't, you won't, you won't, you won't. Will you? You won't, you won't, you won't, you won't. You won't sign ya.
You hear me okay?
Yes, can you hear me?
I can hear you, although you sound a little echoey.
How's this?
Say more.
Check that raise.
Yeah, that sounds good. Make sure we got all the...
Sounds good for what?
Record. Oh, I'm sorry, Jamal. I didn't mean to. We're getting ready to record the introduction to your podcast episode, and I must have accidentally called you in addition to Nate. I apologize.
It's all good. You still coming down this weekend?
Next weekend. I should be down there.
Oh, next weekend? All right. Well, if you make it down, man, make sure you give me a holler.
I will.
All right.
Sorry about that, Jamal.
Hi.
See you later.